Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. I'm David Bowes, your host. Socrates in the City is the name of a series of events, usually in New York, in which prominent men and women are invited to speak before interested professionals and intellectuals about the big questions in life. Who are we? Why are we here? What does life mean? Inspired by the admonition of Socrates that the unexamined life is not worth living, Socrates in the City was founded by author Eric Metaxas, who hoped to inspire civil debate and critical thinking about these big questions in life. Dr. Stephen Meyer, the director of the Center for Science and Culture, was recently invited to speak at a Socrates in the City event in Washington, D.C. He was there to discuss the question, is there a controversy about the theory or theories of evolution, and if so, why does that matter? With special thanks to Eric Metaxas and SocratesInTheCity.com, we are able to share with you excerpts from this event. As I mentioned, the idea behind Socrates in the City events is to encourage the discussion of big questions and controversial issues with civility and to have fun doing it. An abridgment of the introduction of Dr. Meyer by Mr. Metaxas will give you a flavor of what that is like and why the questions raised by Dr. Meyer should be encouraged, not censored.
My name is Eric Metaxas, and about 11 years ago, a number of us in New York City decided that New York was an especially thoughtless kind of place where we did not ask the big questions in life, and that perhaps we ought to do something about that. We took the name Socrates in the City because Socrates, of course, famously said the unexamined life is not worth living, and then he killed himself, as you know. He said, it's just not worth living. And he said, that's that. So, no, he said that. And I think that, of course, he was right, that we ought to think more deeply about life and about the big questions of life. And I did feel in New York City, as a person of faith in particular, we tended not in polite society to ask the big questions about what we half-jokingly call life, God, and other small topics. And it seemed to me that there ought to be a civil place to examine the big questions, who we are, where do we come from, how did we get here, where might we be going, among other things, to talk about the relationship between faith and science, to ask the questions that maybe were not being asked, certainly not being answered. We think it's important to ask these questions in a tone of civility, to allow people to ask questions of the speaker as well, and to challenge the speaker, because we think that these ideas ought to be able to stand up and we ought to have fun in the Q&A. So if we have enough time in the Q&A for you to ask a question, feel free to do that. We really do think civility is important, and if you disagree with that, you're a jerk. So thank you very much. Okay, let me now introduce our speaker, and it's not easy to be a speaker at Socrates in the City because you really don't get a word in edgewise, as they have all found out. But you have to be not just a great thinker, but a good speaker, because there are many, many academics who really can't explain their ideas very well. And of course, many academics who have no good ideas to explain. But in this case, we have an academic with great ideas, and he has a knack for explaining them. So let me just say then, he's the director, Stephen Meyer, of the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. He is a founder of the Intelligent Design Movement. That is an extraordinary thing. Whatever you think of the Intelligent Design Movement, and tonight we're going to think more deeply about that. He's also a founder of the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture, which is Intelligent Design's primary intellectual and scientific headquarters. I've been very impressed by them, I must say. Otherwise, Stephen Meyer wouldn't be here. And I do think we need to think much more deeply about these issues and these ideas, about where we come from. Very important to think about it, even if you don't draw the same conclusions as our speaker or as me. Dr. Meyer is a Cambridge University-trained philosopher of science. He's the author of many peer-reviewed publications in technical, scientific, philosophical, and other books and journals. His signal contribution to intelligent design theory is given most fully in his book, Signature in the Cell, DNA and the Evidence for Intelligent Design, of which we have copies available outside. Signature in the Cell, which Dr. Meyer abbreviates SITC, is of course an infringement on Socrates in the City's abbreviation of SITC. And we've got some New York lawyers that are going to hit you hard. They're going to hit you hard, Meyer, and you're going to rethink the whole abbreviation thing before this month is out. Dr. Meyer earned his PhD in the history and philosophy of science, as I said, from Cambridge for his dissertation on the history of the origin of life biology and the methodology of the historical sciences. And no, I won't repeat that sentence. He has previously worked as a geophysicist, and haven't we all, right? He got his undergraduate degree in physics and geology. He's recently co-written or edited, no one knows, two books, Darwinism, Design and Public Education, and Science and Evidence of Design in the Universe. His work has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, First Things, National Review, and Tiger Beat magazine. In the Tiger Beat article, he proves that Leif Garrett and Justin Bieber are descended from a common ancestor. And that common ancestor, of course, is much guiltier than Adam and Eve combined. So, on that inappropriately silly note, it's my privilege to welcome Dr. Stephen Meyer to the podium of Socrates in the City. Thank you.
Dr. Stephen Meyer then took the podium and described how the media and cultural elite have declared the theory of evolution off limits for controversy or question. Yet the discovery of encoded information in DNA sets forth a challenge regarding the origin of life that Darwin never addressed. In this abridgment of Dr. Meyer's remarks, he describes how he used Darwinian methods to come to a non-Darwinian conclusion about what information at the cellular level indicates about the origin of life.
Now, the burden of my talk tonight is to show that there is a huge disparity between what is going on in biology at the highest levels of inquiry and this cultural media consensus about this topic. So the question I'm going to be addressing tonight as a Socrates in the City speaker is this. Is there a scientific controversy about evolution, the theory of evolution, or theories of evolution? As we'll see, there's important distinction there. And if so, why does that matter? My initial entree into questions of biological origins was in respect to a question that Darwin himself didn't even address, which is the question of the origin of the very first life. Many people don't realize it, but in The Origin of Species, Darwin didn't attempt to explain the origin of the very first life. Rather, he presupposed that first life already existed and that new forms of life then evolved from that simpler pre-existing form of life. And so since 1859, the question of the origin of life has been a kind of asterisk on evolutionary theory. It's been an outstanding question. And indeed, what I discovered, despite what I had learned in university, is that it has been very much an unanswered question from the standpoint of orthodox evolutionary theory. Now, I first learned about this in 1985. I was a young scientist. I was working for an oil company not far from Fort Worth. One weekend, a fascinating conference came to town. I'd long been interested not only in science, but maybe like the Socrates in the City folk, interested in the intersection of science with the big questions. Now, at that conference, I encountered a scientist named Charles Thaxton, who had just published a book with two other very distinguished scientists called The Mystery of Life's Origin. It was chapter and verse on the many problems that scientists had encountered trying to explain the origin of life from a purely undirected evolutionary standpoint, what's known in technical jargon as chemical evolutionary theory, the attempt to explain the origin of the first life from simpler pre-existing chemicals. I was under the impression at this time, having done two science degrees, that the evolutionary theorists had this question sewn up like everything else that was presented in the textbooks, but it turned out not to be the case. At this conference, there were people at the absolute highest level who were specialists, origin of life biochemists, who were mainly there to confess their ignorance of this topic. And it was a fascinating discussion. And it turned out that the reason that scientists were so uncertain about how life had begun is that they were unable to explain a number of things, but in particular, they were unable to explain one of the most important discoveries of modern biology in the latter half of the 20th century, which was the discovery by Watson and Crick of the information-bearing properties of the DNA molecule. You remember in 1953, Watson and Crick first elucidated the structure of the DNA molecule. In 1957, a few years later, Crick put forward something called the sequence hypothesis. And the sequence hypothesis maintained, if you imagine the famed double helix molecule, The idea of the sequence hypothesis is that there are chemicals running along the interior of the molecule, four chemicals called bases or nucleotide bases, that function like alphabetic characters in a written language or digital characters in a machine code. You may have heard the quote from Bill Gates, who said that DNA is like a software program, only much more complex than any we've ever written. And the reason for that is that these four chemicals, which function like software code or a section of written text, are conveying information in virtue of their specific arrangements. It's not the shape of these chemicals that matters. It's not their chemical properties. It's their arrangement. And in virtue of their arrangement, they actually convey instructions for building the proteins and protein machines that every cell in every living organism needs to stay alive. Now, why did this discovery create such a big problem for those trying to explain the origin of the first life as the result of undirected evolutionary processes? Well, the problem was that this information is absolutely essential to life. If you're trying to explain the origin of life, you've got to explain the origin of all the machinery that is in the cell that keeps it alive. That machinery is usually made of proteins. Those proteins are constructed via a complex information processing system in accord with digital code stored along this long, fascinating molecule. So this was the mind-blowing discovery of the latter half of the 20th century. It's information running the show inside life. And if you want to explain the origin of life, therefore, you've got to explain the origin of that code. And as I began to think about this more deeply, I began to wonder about the question of design. According to the Darwinians, Richard Dawkins, for example, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Life looks designed, but it's not really designed. Why is that the case? Well, because we have this undirected Darwinian mechanism called natural selection, acting on random variations and mutations that can produce the appearance of design without there being any designing hand behind it, no guidance at all. But in the case of this debate about the origin of life, we had a striking appearance of design, digital code, similar to what we find in a software program, run according to design patterns and design logic that are actually used by programmers inside the cell. And yet we found that there was no undirected, purely undirected, unguided mechanism that could explain away that appearance. So was it possible that that appearance of design could actually be indicating actual design? Now, the Darwinian move from 1859 on was always to say things, yes, they do look designed, but remember, that's an illusion. The undirected, unguided process of natural selection acting on random variation can explain away that appearance. So I wondered, was it possible, at least at the point of the origin of the first life, that we might be looking at evidence not just of apparent design, but of, in fact, actual design? Now, that led me on a long intellectual journey, and I tell the story of that in the book, but in brief, it's this. I began to wonder if it was possible to make a rigorous scientific argument for the concept of intelligent design. In the 80s, there were people, including this Dr. Thaxton, who had an influence on my intellectual development, who were suggesting this idea as a kind of intuitively plausible idea. If you have information, maybe there was a mind behind it. Information is a mind product in our experience. Code typically comes from a programmer. Okay. So I began to wonder, could that intuitive connection between information and intelligence be developed in a rigorous scientific way? And oddly, somewhat ironically, the answer came for me as a result of studying Darwin. And in particular, the method of reasoning that Darwin used in The Origin of Species to investigate the remote past. He used a method of reasoning that's distinctive of historical scientific endeavor. You can't go back and repeat what happened in the past. You have to reconstruct what happened in the past using clues from the present. And the method of reasoning that scientists use when they're doing that is called inference to the best explanation, or sometimes it's also called the method of multiple competing hypotheses. And Darwin was very self-consciously using this method when he developed his case for descent with modification by natural selection in The Origin of Species. And as I began to study this method, I realized it was also applicable to analyzing the question of the origin of life. And there was a key question that I had to address, and that is, Darwin says we should be looking for the best or the better explanation. What does it mean to be a best explanation? And one day I was reading the front piece of a 19th century work in historical geology by the scientist who was, in fact, one of Darwin's key mentors, named Charles Lyell, and a light bulb went on for me, because Lyell was answering that question. And he answered it in the same way that Darwin did as well. And that is, if you're going to make an inference about what happened in the past, you want to infer that cause which best explains the events in the present. But what does it mean to be best? It means to be a cause which we know from our uniform and repeated experience is capable of producing the effect in question. Lyell put it this way, he called them causes now in operation. And this was Darwin and Lyell's principle. If you're going to reconstruct the cause of an event in the remote past, you want to invoke a cause which you know has the power to produce the effect in question. And if you're lucky, you'll look at evidence that has only one such cause, and you'll be able to definitively establish what happened in the past. Okay? Now, when I began to realize how they were reasoning about the past, I realized that way of reasoning applies to the whole question of the origin of the information necessary to produce the first life. I came across another passage in my studies that also was a seminal moment. Light came on. Henry Quassler, leading early information scientist who was a leader in the application of information theory to molecular biology. Offhand comment, early in one of his books, he says, the creation of new information is habitually associated with conscious activity. Translation, it's a cause now in operation. It's a cause that we know from uniform and repeated experience that is capable of producing information. And then I begin to wonder, well, if we know of a cause that can produce information, and we know of no other cause that produces information, at least in an ultimate sense, which is what I had already been discovering, investigating these scientists trying to explain the origin of the ultimate information in life, then perhaps when we see information, there is only one cause for the origin of information, and that is intelligence. And so it becomes possible from the information in DNA to infer that there was in fact an intelligence behind life. And that, in a sense, a short sketch of the argument I developed in Signature in the Cell. Again, I quote Bill Gates. He says, human DNA is like a computer program, but far more advanced than any we've ever created. Takes a programmer to make a program. That's what we know from experience. In fact, what we know generally is that information, whatever form we find it, when we find information and trace it back to its ultimate source, we do invariably come to a mind, not a material process. So the information at the foundation of life, I argue in Signature in the Cell, points back to a designing intelligence, to a designing mind, not an undirected process. So we don't just have an impasse for chemical evolutionary theory, we actually have a positive reason to consider the design hypothesis, the design argument that was set aside in the Enlightenment by the philosophers and then later by Darwin in the 19th century. So I do a mischievous thing in Signature in the Cell. I use a Darwinian method, the Darwinian method of reasoning, to come to a non-Darwinian conclusion. So I may be right or I may be wrong, but nothing that Darwin did refuted me. And people citing Darwinian processes don't refute what I argued in Signature either.
That concludes this edition of ID the Future. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting the work of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture by going to idthefuture.com and clicking the yellow donate button. Audio from Socrates in the City was used with permission from Eric Metaxas. This podcast is copyright 2012, the Discovery Institute. All rights reserved.